This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. Boy, do we have an exciting episode for you today. I can't wait to get started talking to this guest because she has information that is going to change what I grew up learning into a whole new realm, and it's going to happen right here on this episode.
Ooh, this sounds really exciting. What problem are we solving today?
How do we know dinosaurs could fly?
How do we know that dinosaurs could fly? Ooh, I think I'm gonna learn a lot in this episode too. Who's our guest today, Jeff?
Our guest today is the wonderful Dr. Jingmei O'Connor. She is Associate Curator of Fossil Reptiles at the Field Museum in Chicago.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Jingmei.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be chatting with you today.
Well, we are thrilled to have you. And can I just say, the Field Museum was one of my favorite places in the whole world. So I'm really excited that you're here. But let's start talking about dinosaurs. Can I ask, how did you get into it? Were you one of those kids that loved dinosaurs, you know, from birth, basically?
Actually, I am not. I am like the one paleontologist. I know. Every other paleontologist has these like really cute pictures of them when they're like 3 to 5 years old holding little dinosaur toys.
Okay.
And they're like, this is me. I always knew I wanted to be a paleontologist. And I'm like, yeah, I have pictures of me playing witch quite extensively. And I was like, all my other colleagues knew they wanted to be paleontologists, I wanted to put spells on people and be a witch.
I love it.
Yeah. So I discovered paleontology quite late in life, like when I was around 18 years old in college.
But
I fell in love with the idea of evolution, like how animals change through time, how life has gone from a single cellular organism to like the incredible diversity of animals that we see alive on our planet today. Like that process just blows my mind. It fascinates me. Yeah. So then I decided, you know, I was already a geologist, a geology major. And if you want to study evolution through geology, you become a paleontologist.
Okay. So it didn't happen right away with those 3 to 5 year old, here's me and my dinosaur toys, but it did sort of happen naturally from geology to paleontology. So that leads me to what made you choose geology in terms of your major at first?
Well, in that case, I was inspired by my mom. I know that's like so cliche, but my mom
is awesome.
Yeah, right? I mean, my mom is just one of the most amazing people I've ever met in my life. She's so hardworking. She's so smart. She's funny. She's just charismatic, like just a really wonderful woman. And she did her PhD when I was a kid, you know, so I saw her.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. I got to go out with her collecting rocks and minerals and sometimes fossils while she was doing her degree.
Okay.
Yeah. And so then I decided to follow in her path, but I really didn't know what my interest was within this broad field of geology. Like, what did I want to do as a geologist? I really had no clue until I met a paleontologist named Don Prothro, who's like the fossil rhino expert of the world. And I mean, I have no interest in rhinos. I mean, they're cool too, sure. But you know, he's got that area covered, I would say. But yeah, he really, you know, his passion for paleontology was, I guess you could say, infectious. And now I'm fully infected.
Wonderful.
That's wonderful. So can you kind of explain to our listeners what the connection is between geology and paleontology and how one leads to the other?
Cool. Yeah, sure. So geology is the study of Earth, like all the rocks that make up Earth, how they form, the processes that shape our continents. But in these rocks, you sometimes have the remains of once living animals or organisms. trapped within the layers of rock. And we call these things fossils. So like geologists would find these and sometimes use them in order to determine how old the rocks were. And they also started to notice how life would be changing as, you know, you go from rocks from one age to another. And so that became the field of paleontology, which basically means the study of ancient life.
Which is so cool. I'm like following all this going, yes, this sounds so amazing.
It really is.
We are definitely science geeks. And yes, dinosaurs are definitely one of those high excitement type topics. With paleontology, when you start to study it, do you know, like you just mentioned, the doctor that sort of had the rhinos covered, do you pick certain species that you want to study? Do you pick a certain time and era? How does that happen?
So if you loved paleontology since you were a little kid, then maybe there's one group of animals that you've always loved more than others and you've always wanted to work on. So that is definitely the case with some people. But for me, you know, I just really liked just the idea of evolution. So I wasn't really attached to any one group of organisms. Okay. So I always jokingly say that I am an equal opportunity extinct organism enthusiast. I love all fossils.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
So that should be a group.
I know, right? And I have to see what the acronym is if it sounds cool. So when I applied to go to do my PhD, I applied to work with lots of different people who work on very different things. So I applied to work with one guy who studies fossil echinoderms, things like crinoids or starfish. Yeah, I also applied to work with a lady who studies fossil poop, which we call coprolites. Kind of funny. And then I also applied to work with a guy who works on marine reptiles like mosasaurs, plesiosaurs. Extinct reptiles that get grouped with dinosaurs, but they're not dinosaurs. No dinosaur has ever become fully aquatic, meaning living in that water all the time. So if you see a fossil reptile living in the water all the time, like an ichthyosaur, looks very fish-like. It's definitely not a dinosaur. And that's actually my favorite group of animals. Like I love plesiosaurs, those really long-necked animals with flippers in the water that are so weird. We actually don't really know where they fit in the reptile tree. But then I ended up making the practical decision to work with a curator named Dr. Luis Chiappe at the LA Natural History Museum. And he told me if I worked with him, I would work on Mesozoic birds. So the earliest fossil birds that we know of and how these animals evolved from dinosaurs and how they evolved to then also look like the birds we see alive today. So I thought, you know, this is an area of research where there was lots of new fossils being found. So I said, you know, being a paleontologist is really tough. It's very competitive. So I said, I'm going to work in an area where there's lots of new fossils because it means I'll have a good chance of being a successful paleontologist and one day getting to work in an amazing place like the Field Museum. And it worked out.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Nicely done.
Yeah. The question is how do you know that dinosaurs flew, basically? So can you tell us a little about the evolution of the research that you discovered and how you kind of looked at fossils throughout the years? Because that, to me, is also so fascinating.
Yeah, well, okay. So all the time I've been a paleontologist, we've had a drastic change in our way of thinking about the evolution of flight in dinosaurs. Huge, massive change, like really exciting. And that's one thing I love about paleontology is you can discover one new fossil and everything you think you knew just changes. So you really need to be willing to say that you were wrong if you're going to be a paleontologist. Scientists in general, there's no shame in that. So when I first started, you know, studying paleontology, we thought that the only flying dinosaurs were birds. So if you wanted to understand how birds evolved from dinosaurs, you could ask the question, how did flight evolve in dinosaurs? Because that's how birds, you know, flying dinosaurs evolve. And then while I was still in college, a really cool dinosaur named Microraptor was discovered. And Microraptor is a tiny relative of something like Velociraptor. So it's a member of a group of dinosaurs called Dromaeosauridae. So it also includes like Dromaeosaurus and Deinonychus, dinosaurs some people are pretty familiar with. This tiny relative of Velociraptor had feathers, long feathers on its arms and on its legs. And these long feathers formed a wing-like surface. So it looks like this dinosaur has wings on its arms and its legs. But the thing is, we'd actually found dinosaurs with wings that were not flying because their wings were actually kind of small. So we actually know Yeah. So in dinosaurs, wings evolved first for something else, something we're not quite sure about, maybe for like display, look at me, I'm very pretty, you know, attracting mates.
Yeah, sure.
But the feathers in the wings on the arms and the legs of Microraptor showed something really special. The feathers were asymmetrical. So what this means is when you look at a bird feather, it has that like central spine, that rachis, right?
Yes.
And then it has vein coming off either side. And when sometimes you'll find a feather where one vein is much narrower than the other vein. And so these are feathers you only find in the wing. And you only find them in the wing of birds that fly, because some birds have lost their flight, right? Like an ostrich. So this asymmetry of feathers is something that's linked to flight. And we found it in the wings of Microraptor on the arms and the legs. So this revealed a dinosaur that seems to be flying with four wings.
Wow.
And leg wings.
That's incredible. Now, the
thing is, really cool. But the thing is, people at that time thought that maybe one appearance of flight in dinosaurs, it led to both Microraptor and birds. So that during the evolution of bird flight, they first went through a four-wing stage like Microraptor and then evolved into the two-wing state like form that we see in living birds. So still one origin of flight in dinosaurs. Now, fast forward 10 years later, now I'm a doctor and I'm working in China at this really cool institute where Microraptor is housed. And we find a new dinosaur, which it named I Chi, and this is kind of a spoiler alert. I Chi in Chinese means strange wing. And so this little dinosaur, like the first specimens of this dinosaur, it's a group called Scansoriopterygidae. That's a very difficult name. I'm not the one who
you said it
out.
Very well.
No spelling test today.
I apologize to everyone. But the first Scansoriopterygid, they have three fingers. Like birds also have three fingers. The dinosaurs closely related to birds have three fingers. And one finger was really, really long in the Scansoriopterygids. Huh. So people thought, hey, maybe it's for feeding. Like it sticks its finger into a little hole in a trunk and it probes for grubs. That was the original hypothesis. Then when I Chi was found, we actually realized that that elongate finger was for supporting a wing membrane, which is actually the same thing you see in pterosaurs, which are flying reptiles that are not dinosaurs, but are all but are closely related. So in pterosaurs, the outer finger is super long, and that's what supports the wing. And in bats, all the fingers are super long, and then there's basically skin, webbed skin between the super long fingers that then forms that wing. So now we know that dinosaurs, this one group of dinosaurs, Scansoriopterygids, had one finger that was super elongate, kind of like pterosaurs, but not that long, that would have formed a little wing that kind of looked like something like a flying squirrel. So this type of dinosaur was gliding. It did not have powered flight like we see in birds or
Right.
So suddenly we realized that dinosaurs had this whole diversity of wing shapes. Some of them flew with two wings, some flew with four wings made out of feathers, some flew using flaps of skin, not using feathers at all. Wow. They had powered flight, they had gliding flight. And this made us realize that actually flight has evolved in dinosaurs at least four different times. So that now we know that birds are flying dinosaurs, but birds are not the only dinosaurs that evolved flight.
I don't even know what to say. Wow, I learned so much. And I just want to say you found this all from fossils, right? Like you didn't find like a real creature with skin and all this kind of stuff. You just looked at rocks and the fossils maybe that were left and you deduced all of this, right?
Yes, but these fossils did preserve skin. Like actually that membrane that this Scansoriopterygids used to fly is a skin membrane. And also feathers are structures that are derived from your skin, same as hair and fingernails. And these things, they normally do not fossilize. Like normally when you think of a fossil of a vertebrate animal, you think just of a skeleton, right? And that's most of the time what we have. But in really, really, really rare, really exceptional cases, we sometimes get fossils that preserve soft tissues. That means everything that surrounds the skeleton that is normally soft and squishy and normally rots away. But if the animal gets fossilized fast enough, then sometimes these soft tissues like skin, like feathers, sometimes even things like lungs can also become part of the fossil. And these provide these really, really rare and exceptional exceptional clues that help us to then understand these extinct organisms. Because without these soft tissues, we right. never would have realized Microraptor was flying. Without
exactly.
these soft tissues, we never would have realized Ansoriopterygians
right.
were flying. So even though these things are really rare, we really rely on them to understand animals. So if you think about all these extinct animals that we only know from the bones,
right.
think about how wrong we may be interpreting.
Oh my gosh.
Like, what if we had soft tissues? Maybe we'd be like, whoa, like
that is not what we thought was happening.
That's,
exactly.
That sort of leads me right into the question I was just thinking in terms of in the intro that I did for you, it was, you're going to be talking about these animals in the long distant past that we all know and love and bringing it into our present. We all think about dinosaurs and we think, oh, that's the past. That's old. That's dusty. That's, you know, we know all of that. And you are talking about stuff that is completely new and changing everything that we thought we knew in the past.
That's exciting.
So paleontology and dinosaurs sounds like a whole new exciting field, which is just, it's not completely new because we know about dinosaurs, but what we know may not be the right stuff.
I would say like that probably 90% of everything we think we know is either wrong or not quite right. I mean,
okay.
If you think about it,
90%. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, a lot. Because
that's a lot.
There's so much we don't know about our natural world, even about animals that are alive today. There's
right.
a lot we don't know. And if
yes.
that's true when we have the living animal there to study, can you imagine how little we know about animals like Ichi that lived 161 million years ago?
Right.
And,
oh my gosh.
You know, we only have most of the skeleton, but the skeleton's kind of crushed. And we have a little bit of the soft tissue, but mostly just a little bit of skin and feathers. We have no idea what its metabolic rates were and its body temperature. For example,
right.
birds have higher body temperatures than mammals. They have really, really high metabolisms. So when did this evolve? Did this evolve with flight? Did this, you know, evolve? Did higher metabolic rates evolve multiple times? Every time something involves flight, you know, these other physiological changes to the soft tissues happening that we really know nothing about. But also, so many fossils are really incomplete. Like, for
yes.
example, you know, I love to tell
right.
people, well, you know, they ask, why did I move to China? And what I do is I show them an example of a Mesozoic bird from China, which is beautiful and complete. And, you know, the whole skeleton is just, you know, spread
oh,
out.
Wow.
Like, all the bones still connected the way they should be in life. And you have nice feathers. And then
uh-huh.
I show them a Mesozoic bird from North America, from the United States. And all you have is one bone from the foot. And that is that's been used to name a species. So for that whole species, all you know is what one part of its foot looked like. And then you have to imagine, you have to try to figure out what the
right.
all the biology of that
wow.
foot was. So it's incredibly challenging, but actually that's why I really like paleontology. I like the challenge. I like that there's always new discoveries completely changing what you think you knew. So it's a really dynamic field. There's always new things going on, always new discoveries, new methods that we come up with to get
oh,
new information
yeah.
out of fossils. So for example, you can like shoot fossils with laser beams. It's a technique called Raman spectroscopy. And you can,
okay.
You
yes.
can tell what color a dinosaur egg was doing this technique. This is something that's very new that was only figured out in 2018. Or
wow.
you can take a fossil and you can put it in a CT imaging scanner. And then you can see what the brain of that dinosaur would have looked like, what its inner ear would have looked like. These are things that tell you about its behavior, about its
wow.
intelligence, like how good it could smell, how good it could see.
Wow.
All these
yeah.
Yeah, new methods that are really extracting new exciting data about extinct animals that's really allowing us to bring these animals to life like we've never been able to do before.
Wow. I just think of all of, you know, like when I was a kid and everybody learned the name of the dino, which some of the names they aren't even the same as when, you know, what I learned. And you just think about kids being able to, like you said, like the dinosaurs kind of come to life, all of the different organisms. And, you know, the other thing that I was thinking about is, you know, as you're explaining all this is, like, we don't know about the environment. Like you were talking about that, the environment that occurred 160 million years ago and what effect that had on that particular organism and why it evolved the way it did. We can guess it. And I know we can get things from the rocks and kind of theorize what was happening in the environment. But is that part of the thing that you try to take into account too when you're looking at animals and try to figure out what they did and why?
Definitely. And there are lots of different methods that we can use to figure out what temperature it used to be.
Right.
Like we use isotopes that we can extract from fossil bone, but also from rock layers. We can also determine what the oxygen levels were in the atmosphere.
Right. Okay.
And we can tell what rainfall was like using different fossil indicators. And these things help us to put together the environment that extinct animals lived in order to better understand why they evolved to be the way they did. So for example, like you've heard that, you know, like 400 or 350 million years ago, they were really, really big insects, right? Like, you know, like
I would not have wanted to live then.
Me too. They're like dragonflies that are like a meter wingspan. Right?
No, thank you.
Yes.
And it's because actually there was more oxygen in the atmosphere when these insects were alive. And I used to think that it was because the atmosphere was denser, had more, like, you know, it was richer with gas.
Right.
Allowed them to be bigger. But actually, too much oxygen is poisonous. So the way that they were able to get rid of this excess oxygen was by becoming really big. I mean, I don't know the exact particulars of it. You'd have to get somebody on the show who's like an expert on insects. But I was looking into this and I learned that and I was like, wow, you know? So these different aspects of the environment can help us understand the organisms that were living there.
That's just so amazing, right? I feel like there's more layers after layers after layers, right, Jeff?
Yes, absolutely. And that leads me, I gotta ask this question. I'm introduced as Galactic Space Geek Jeff, and I work in a space museum in Colorado. So most of what I'm teaching about is space and rocketry, which is 60 to 100 years in the past. And you just mentioned 160 million years in the past. Yeah. Is there something that you do to, as a paleontologist, to sort of help shift your brain to think in that sort of a scale, that long ago?
I think basically it's practice, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when you first start thinking about, wow, 50 million years, 100 million years, 300 million years, like your mind can't really conceive of these intervals of time. But the more you do it, the more comfortable you become. And then you're like, oh, you know, 5 million years, no big deal. Like, I'm not even kidding. 5 million years is a very short period of time in my mind.
I'm sure.
Okay.
I'm sure. So I have a question. So there's scientists all over the world who are studying different parts of paleontology. Like, how do you collaborate, meaning get all of this information together? So if someone makes a really big find, I mean, I know you write papers and whatever, but is there a way that a group of you can get together and be like, oh, this is what we think this is? Or how do you work together as scientists to decide this?
To make it easy for everyone all around the world to work together, we use a single language to communicate. And lucky for native English speakers like myself, the language we use is English. So for example, when I lived in China for 10 years, I don't speak very good Chinese. I can get by, but I definitely do not speak scientific Chinese, right?
Okay.
But all my colleagues speak English. And to get your PhD in China, you have to take an English exam. You have to be able to show that you can communicate in English, because this makes it very easy for us to all read each other's research. And what we do is, like, say you find a new fossil bird and it preserves something like lungs, which was, you know, the case when I was in China. I was describing this bird that was 120 million years old. It looked like it had lung tissue. I don't know anything about bird lungs because I'm a geologist. So I'm reading all these papers. I'm trying to figure out about bird lungs. And I noticed that most of the papers are written by this one guy named John Mayna. So I looked him up. He works in South Africa. He's a South African. And I say, hey, I've got this fossil with lungs. You know, would you like to help study this with me so that to make sure that, you know, it's like, I was able to read all his papers, but I'm still not an expert in bird lungs and I didn't want to get something wrong. So I just invited him to kind of check the work that I was doing and make sure that I was understanding bird lungs correctly. And I do this a lot, you know, when I start doing my own background research, I'll notice that one name comes up and that, or that their papers need to be what I think are the best. And then I'll reach out to them and ask them to collaborate. And so this is generally how we work together.
Is that why when you see the papers, you have like 20 names or whatever listed on there?
I say the more the merrier, you know, like I think it's a good way to develop good relationships with your colleagues.
Oh, yes.
And, yeah. And scientists are sometimes too competitive with each other. And we're actually sometimes not very nice to each other. Oh. And I really want to move away from that. Oh. I want to move towards, you know, an environment or a society of scientists who share data with each other, or, you know, collaborate with each other freely and don't see each other as competition. I think we'll learn and we'll figure out a lot more stuff a lot more quickly that way.
Yes,
I love it. I love that idea. So I know we're getting close to our time, but I have to squeeze in one of my favorite questions. Not like you haven't done some amazing stuff already and been super excited about it, which we can hear in your voice. Is there a dinosaur that you are hoping you will find something new about in the future? Do you have a hope? Do you have a favorite of, I hope I find something about whatever?
I hope you have like a lot of time, because I have a very, very long wish list of fossils that I would like to find. For example, these very cool Scansoriopterygids I mentioned, only 5 fossils have ever been found belonging to this group of dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So there is a lot we don't know. So I would love to find more Scansoriopterygids. That's a big one on my wish list. Another one is that the oldest fossil bird is Archaeopteryx. It's the only bird from the Jurassic. And then we have a 20 million year gap in the fossil record before we have any more fossil birds. And then 130 million years, you know, old birds, we have a ton of different taxa, lots of different shapes and sizes. So that 20 million year gap in the fossil record is clearly super critical for us to understand how this early diversification of birds happened during the Cretaceous.
Okay.
So that's my
number. That sounds exciting.
I know. The thing is, finding birds is really, 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 really hard to do. Because birds are really small and their bones are hollow to make it like easier for them to fly, to make them lighter.
Right.
So they don't fossilize very well. A lot of times you go out looking for birds, and if you're lucky, you find fossils, you know, because fossils are rare in themselves. But the chances of finding a bird are very, very low. So, for example, there's a really cool deposit called the Green River Formation in Wyoming. It's only 52 million years old, so it's a lot younger than the stuff I usually work on. But for every 30,000 fish fossils that are found, you find one fossil bird. So that gives you an idea just how rare fossil birds are. So really hard to find. So basically, you know, I would settle for any discovery of a
any discovery.
Love it.
From the Mesozoic.
There you go. Well, and I know you have to be able to share your passion about this. You have a book coming out this year for kids, right?
Yeah. So for all you kids who are interested in learning more about Mesozoic birds and the many different types of flying dinosaurs, I would love for you to check out this book that I just recently wrote called When Dinosaurs Conquered the Skies, that is being put out by Porto Kids Publishing. It comes out November 1st this year. So look forward to checking it out.
Oh, that'll be so much fun. So now, even though we could talk about this for hours, we do come to the part in our show where we ask you for a challenge. So I'm curious to see what your challenge is for our listeners.
Well, okay. My challenge for all of you is to count how many different species of dinosaurs you see today. I, for one, have seen at least 5 different species of dinosaurs just on my way to work this morning.
Oh my God.
Can you help us out with that a little bit?
Yes.
Okay, I know you work at the museum, but I don't think that's what you're counting.
Oh, okay. You're right. No, I also saw the Brachiosaurus. So that's 6 dinosaurs, but I saw a sparrow, Passer domesticus. I saw a pigeon, Columba something. I also saw a seagull and a robin. And I saw a cardinal, one of those red angry birds.
Okay.
And then plus the Brachiosaurus skeleton that's mounted outside the Field Museum. So I have seen 6 species of dinosaurs today.
That is right. That's an awesome challenge. Now I'm going to want to count dinosaurs because we have a lot of birds in our backyard. I'm just going to say there's a dinosaur and there's a dinosaur. People are going to look at me like I'm crazy or something. I'm just saying, no, they really are.
So vegans and vegetarians aside, many of us, most of us have probably eaten dinosaurs before, which is pretty cool, right? You know, we think of dinosaurs as they're going to eat us, but actually we eat dinosaurs on a regular basis. But also this dichotomy, like this mammal dominance versus dinosaur dominance, it's not really so black and white as we like would really think. There are actually mammals that are 125 million years old that preserve the remains of baby dinosaurs inside their stomach. So like the, you know, the dinosaurs eating mammals eating dinosaurs. This has been going back
and
forth for a very long time. Oh my gosh. I did not know that either.
I now totally understand why you're so passionate and why you love what you do.
Yeah.
This has been fascinating.
This has been a fascinating, awesome show. Thank you so much for being on Salt for Kid, Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you so much for having me. I could talk about dinosaurs all day.
So I thought I was going to learn some new stuff today, and I did. And now, with that new stuff, my favorite thing about new information and learning, as soon as I go outside the next time, I am going to be on the lookout for dinosaurs. What about you, Jen?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I have already noticed them since we taped this one earlier. I've already been counting. In my backyard alone, I've seen like 10 or 15 of them. And you look at birds so differently now, right?
Absolutely. We look at birds differently, and this already starts to make me think, what more are we going to learn in the next 20 years as our listeners grow up? What else are we going to know about dinosaurs that we don't know right now that Dr. Jingmei and her team and all the other paleontologists are working on right now? This is so much fun to learn.
It absolutely is. Okay, so if any of you go out and see a dinosaur in your backyard or around the park, whatever, make sure that you leave us a message or tag us on our social media. We are at KidSolve at Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And be sure to check out our website page about Dr. O'Connor so you can see some of the cool work that she's doing. It is solveforkids.com. We hope to see some really amazing pictures of dinosaurs, don't we, Jeff?
Absolutely. And if you don't happen to see one, draw a picture of a dinosaur. Whether that's a dino or a bird. That's a slightly different challenge, but now we are starting to cross-pollinate our episodes and the cool things that we are learning here on
Solve It for Kids.